Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. This is a programme where we look at the story shaping economies, politics and business worldwide. And today we're going to look at three big issues that are exercising the minds of the great and good from Berlin to Washington and Dublin. First, we're going to take a look at Germany, where the political shifts and an upcoming election have stirred the debate on the country's economic and social future. And then this.
Donald Trump continued his exhaustive search for the most qualified people in his line of sight. And he has chosen anti-vax nepo maniac Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services. I know. That sounds insane, but we should all keep an open mind, because that's how the worm gets in.
Yes, the U.S. president-elect Donald Trump is appointing his new dream team, but he also has a complex web of legal challenges facing him. So later in the show, I'm going to be joined by Joe Miller of the Financial Times, and we'll be breaking down exactly where these cases stand and what, if any, implications they have for Donald Trump's presidency. And finally, we'll be zooming back here to Ireland to see what the business community wants from the parties ahead of the general election in 2024. From tax policies, housing and infrastructure, we're going to explore the promises being made and the policies that could shape the future of Irish business. Stay with us for expert analysis and some insight into all of those topics, and you can get in contact with us at takingstock@newstalk.com or on X at StockNT. Between a reduction in employer PRSI, cutting VAT rates for the hospitality sector and a 10 billion euro investment in public transport, there's been several big budgetary pledges from political parties across the board as the starting gun was set to the 2024 election this week. But what are business looking for from the next government? Well, to discuss all that, I'm joined now by Colin Thomas, who is the political correspondent for The Business Post, and also David Broderick, director of the Small Firms Association. You're both very welcome.
Thanks for having us, Mandy.
Now, Colin, I'm going to start with you to try and look at the kind of big macro picture and then the micro picture. So when we're looking at FDI multinationals, try and take me through what they're looking for from their politicians in this budget, and the same really for the smaller micro business, indigenous sector.
I think there's one common thing that links both of them, like at start, and that is energy, right? So that's the starting point in all of this. And we've heard a lot about this running up to the budget. We're going to hear a lot about it in the next couple of weeks and months. For big businesses, for the likes of IBEC, for multinationals, the key thing is energy and infrastructure. Effectively, what they would say is the government have not effectively addressed infrastructural constraints. Now, those include public transport, housing, water connections, the national grid. Because if you're looking to invest in Ireland, you need certainty over all of those things. You need to know that your staff have somewhere to live, that they have somewhere, you know, they have a community, they have all the amenities that you would expect. So that's the first point into the macro picture, I suppose. Mm-hmm. In terms of the smaller firms, there's a number of measures that have been outlined by, you know, the likes of ISMI, the Restaurant Association of Ireland, etc. These include, you know, questions around future increases to the minimum wage, towards the living wage. There's VAT rates, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a minute. There's PRSI changes. There's excise duty. There's commercial rates reviews. There's reviews to, there's one thing that's already been called for is a dedicated minister for tourism and hospitality. Mm. No party has pledged that, I should add.
And yes.
I don't think, yes.
We have 2 weeks to go.
Never know. Yeah. We have 2 weeks to go. So on the one hand, yeah, you have these huge macro big issues facing the country, which I should add, you know, in terms of the energy and infrastructure complaints, they're not just a business issue. They're a population-wide issue. Mm. But then you have all these small changes. And what you see in the last week, first week of the campaign, in relation to those kind of smaller, medium-sized business measures, is each party kind of jockeying for space. We can talk a little bit in a minute about which parties are pitching in which way, because it is quite interesting what we're seeing.
It is interesting, isn't it, David, that even though the macro picture is a complicated one and those large infrastructural deficits that are there are real and challenging, we're hearing them all the time from the IDA and everybody, they do trickle down to small business. And as Connell has said there, things like energy, that's a big issue for small business. Maybe just before we get into talking about what you want to see, because I know you published your manifesto this week, Just remind us the type of business that the SFA represents.
Sure, thanks, Mandy. Well, we look after businesses with 50 employees or less. That's a fairly sizable cohort, about 98% of all the businesses in the country. I think, look, we did a survey recently with Amoric Research, and the three biggest issues, won't be surprised. First on this is business cost. Second is employment and labour-related costs. And the third is difficulties in attracting and retaining talent. So I suppose, look, from our point of view, what we want to see from this next government is a targeted support. That's the big word, targeted. The PRSI rebate is something that we've been calling for, and we're very happy to see that in some of the manifestos, the ones we've seen at the moment. We think the government can set the parameters of that PRSI rebate, and we think that will happen. We think that would be good for across the board, not just one particular sector, because my members are hospitality, they're struggling, and retail. But I can tell you manufacturing is struggling, services is struggling, you name it. So that's the short-term thing in terms of what we can do. But we also want to see a long-term plan and strategy. And
this is your framework that you're calling for, is it?
Sure, absolutely.
So you want the government, when it's reformed in their programme for government, to set out a framework for you for small business, and it would include all of these things underneath
yes,
it.
Absolutely.
What parties that you have seen so far are making a valiant attempt at doing that?
Well, I think this is more of a long-term play, and I haven't seen any specifics around this particular party, but I think all businesses need certainty. Any business needs to be able to plan what they're doing this year, next year, the year after. So you look at the good work we did around our FDI strategy. Fantastic work. Look at the rewards that we're reaping around that. You look at Sláintecare, for example. There's a strategy within place and people have bought into it. So we just need, and we don't mind what party gets into government. We talk to all parties and lobby all parties. But whoever it is needs to have a look at this vital, vital part of society and make sure that they can plan into the future. It's a simple thing. Everybody needs to be able to plan so that they can grow and expand.
But there are parties who, you know, don't have that sort of business-minded bent to them, if you like. Are there parties that you see, I'm just thinking about the Fine Gael manifesto last weekend was their first thing, I think, when they came out of the traps talking about small business. Like, do you think they've made a good attempt at dealing with some of the issues like PRSI, like VAT?
Look, in our role, we talk to all parties. I would say I have no politics, only politics is small business. We think that, you know, in terms of the attempts that have been made, we've spoke to every single party over the last year. And every single party, within their own way, said they want to do something for small business. And why not? The constituency that they have to look after. In terms of those specifics, obviously, we did see, and we were grateful for some of the initiatives under the last administration. The SME test, for example, we think is something solid and concrete that will be very, very helpful going forward, regardless of who's in office. You know, that whatever regulation comes in needs to think small first. That was something that we've been calling for. So we think if there is groundwork set that's there from the past, it's about who gets in next and can we continue this on?
Okay. Mm. One of the words that you've both mentioned repeatedly there is certainty, and that's what businesses want, love and need, no matter how big or small they are. And one of the things, Conal, that has creeped into the parlance in recent, I think over the last year, but particularly in the last couple of months, is we used to talk about a cost of living crisis, but there's increasingly this phrase, a cost of business crisis, right? I think all political parties are in tune to that. The VAT issue that arose last weekend has caused a great deal of uncertainty in business about what exactly Fine Gael are proposing, what exactly Fianna Fáil are proposing. Can you try and explain to us what exactly that is, why there was so much annoyance over not being in the budget? And
I can try.
Yeah.
I can probably try better than the parties. Okay, so just to set the scene a little bit. In the lead up to the budget, there was this huge lobbying campaign, in particular by the Restaurants Association of Ireland, to reinstate the 9% VAT, which was reduced from 13.5% to 9% during the pandemic. Anyway, this was going on for some weeks, the lead up to the budget, and the various sort of Fine Gael who were really pushing for it were very hopeful that kind of in secret they might get it over the line. Fianna Fáil were opposed to it, etc., etc. What happened last Saturday was Fine Gael came out with their business manifesto and effectively said, right, no 9% for you guys, but there's going to be an 11%.
Forever.
Forever. Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Initially, it seemed, 11% for restaurants. Okay, they've done something for restaurants. And then suddenly people realise, hold on a second, you're getting rid of the 9%. So that would effectively mean you're getting rid of the 9% on gas and electricity, which is something that Fianna Fáil in their manifesto, and I should say Fianna Fáil with the finance brief the last few years have extended this in every budget, and in their manifesto they're planning to extend for another 5 years. So on the one hand, you've Fine Gael saying 11%, 9% is gone, but really we're doing this for the restaurant lobby because we know that's a key voter base for us.
Yeah.
The other hand, you've Fianna Fáil saying, do you know what? Your one part, your one sector of society, it's a very Fianna Fáil move, I would add, trying to really go for that kind of middle ground and not try and kowtow to one particular sector. Mm. They're saying, no, do you know what? We're going to extend the 9%. Then fast forward a few days and you effectively have Fine Gael coming out saying, but you're not doing anything for hospitality. And in fact, and it is a fair point to make, extending the 9% in reality would help households, but there's a big question mark of how much it would help businesses. And I should add what Fianna Fáil have proposed is actually quite a radical intervention in the energy sector. Mm. Right, which effectively would reduce the PSO levy, which they say would say about a cost of €450 million, and they would say this would save households and businesses about €40 a month. That may not seem like a lot, and on top of that, they've been promised a €2.5 billion.
Yeah, we're really getting
into the grid.
You're getting the weeds of it now.
But so you zoom out again, and the criticism I think of both parties has been, you could have done this in the budget, you didn't.
Mm.
Why didn't you do it? This looks cynical. In a way, it's probably backfired on both of them a little bit. I think it's probably backfired on Fine Gael a little bit, considering it was Pascal Donoghue who was out quite trenchantly in the weeks before the budget saying, if we reinstate the 9% VAT, we are going to lose €800 million from the Exchequer every year.
And David, like your members then, are they now on to you kind of going, what does this mean? Do they look to you for clarity in a time like this?
Well, I don't know if anyone can kind of clarify, as Conal so eloquently put, in terms of the moment. The
because it's a big decision, right? If you're going to back a party who's going to go into government and say, look, my red line is 9%, my red line is 11%. I'm going to, I'm going to tackle this issue.
Yeah, no, well, certainly, I think anything in terms of cost saving at the moment and some of the elements that Conal has looked at is a positive thing. Again, looking at the particular sector specific, we want to see more across the board. I have restaurants, I have retailers, we have the full gamut. So that's why in terms of, we would have gone to our members and asked what they're looking for. That's why the PRSI rebate for us was the way to go. In terms of wherever it ends up and whatever percentage it ends up, we have one of the highest costs of electricity in Europe.
Mm.
It needs to come down. It needs to start. And anything that we can do to mitigate that is going to be a positive for our members.
And probably just worth adding as well, there still seems to be, it hasn't quite been clarified to me anyway, a question mark over Fine Gael's proposal around the 11%, because they're effectively, the argument would be, well, then you're also pushing up energy costs.
Mm.
But unlike Fianna Fáil, who have launched their manifesto quite early in the day compared to Sinn Féin, Fine Gael, obviously strategic, probably argue with the benefits of that. Fine Gael haven't, they're due to on Sunday. And it'll be very interesting to see what they're proposing around energy.
Yeah, because Simon Harris in his interview on Virgin Media this week seemed to suggest that there was some kind of antidote to the energy problems that this had created. But as you say, a bit on the back foot because they don't have their manifesto out. But you do have your manifesto out. So what else is in there that you want to go through today that the Small Firms Association would like to see?
Yeah, look, I think we've touched on infrastructure and anything that makes Ireland a better place to do business is a positive for
what about the taxation side of things? Are there other things that you'd like to see happen?
Sure,
there?
Yeah. Well, this goes into the recruitment and retention side. I mean, a lot of our members are having difficulty retaining staff and retaining key staff. So there's a lot of significant detail in there that we do think you could tinker around the edges of the tax system. That wouldn't have a huge effect on the exchequer costs and things like, changing the share system. Taking away the tax that's paid on particular elements of shares when we're trying to entice senior management to stay on. Let's make that process easy.
Mm.
Let's make that process in terms of doing shares. There's a thing called salary sacrifice, and that's something where when you make your pension contribution, that's a cost in employers. Why can't we strip out all those particular areas and pull back on those?
Yeah, Conal, that's a good point there, isn't it? Like talent retention, we're at full employment, staff are so important now. Have you seen much evidence of parties talking about that side of business in the first 7 days? No,
not a huge amount.
Probably missing out there a little
bit. Probably. I mean, my own view of it would be if you just take, again, I should say Sinn Féin, worth mentioning, have been light enough on detail in the enterprise, and but they haven't launched their manifesto yet. So I think that'll be Monday. But if you just look at Fine Gael, not a lot. As I say, Fine Gael seem to really be going for the sort of, I would argue, you know, vote getting sort of concrete enough measures, right? But you know, there's probably an argument over some of them. And then there's some vagaries. Action plan for competitiveness. They want to create 300,000 more jobs, but they're really saying exactly how they're going to do it. And the buzzwords you're always kind of hearing is investment. You know, we're going to pump money into it. On the Fianna Fáil side, the one thing that separates, say, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in all of this is that I think Fine Gael have really targeted the small firms, the SMEs, in terms of their measures. Fianna Fáil are actually taking a slightly different approach. They're looking at it from a more macro perspective. They are really looking at it, I think, from a sort of, not just a multinational perspective, but, you know, they're looking at expanding the R&D tax credit, which a lot of companies say is crucial, you know, here, and will only lead to more, you know, more business and employment.
And would something like that be important for Indigenous business as well? Yeah, because we sometimes forget that if you're putting things in place to get the multinationals, it has a positive effect. And actually, that's another thing I've heard a lot of recently, that are we doing enough to bolster the Indigenous sector? Like, does the government look at that enough?
Yeah, and this comes back to our point in terms of creating that roadmap. But we certainly think the R&D tax credit is something we've gone on for a while. It's very complex for smaller businesses. We could simplify it.
Right.
There's also implications. We talked around the tax and the tax treatment of it. We think a pre-approval from the likes of Enterprise Ireland would go a long, long way within that process that would bring more smaller companies in and give them what we want. We want certainty. We want to be able to plan.
It's quite an interesting one because, in a way, you're kind of seeing two different Irelands play out in a way in terms of the business sector. If you look at that as a microcosm, because the R&D tax credit, they're also thinking of expanding it for innovation. Now, most people, you know, speak to a lot of people, they're going, what would that mean? You know,
so how does it actually?
How would it actually? So you've got, you know, small bars, restaurants, cafes, physical spaces in towns and villages, and then you have this kind of somewhat nebulous, you know, FDI multinational model, and they're both part of our economy. It's just about which voter base you're appealing to.
Well, when it comes to votes, as you said, it's probably that small sector that's more important now for the next couple of weeks to them, that's for sure. Listen, guys, we probably could have stayed here for the hour talking about this, but there's another 2 weeks to go, so we might hear from you again. But for now, we're going to leave it there. That was Conal Thomas, political correspondent for The Business Post, and also David Broderick, director of the Small Firms Association. Chaps, thank you both very much for coming in to me today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Andy Johnston. Coming up after the break, with the traditional parties losing ground in Germany, a new alliance is forming. What lies ahead for Europe's largest economy? Welcome back to Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. Now, while we may be focusing on our own election here in Ireland, a far more consequential campaign for Europe in general began this week in Germany, because while voters won't be going to the polls until the 23rd of February, the German election does seem to have a feeling of a defining moment about it, even at this stage. Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Katharina Karcher, who's senior lecturer at the University of Birmingham with a research focus on political violence. Katharina, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hello, Mandy. Good evening.
Now, it's probably a good idea just to remind all our listeners why this coalition came together and who exactly they are.
So that's a very good question to start with, because what we have seen is a so-called traffic light coalition, which had three members. And in many ways, that seemed like a great idea, because everybody brought something to the table. So there was the Social Democrats, and of course, that's the chancellor that we currently still have, Olaf Scholz. Then there was the Green Party, and they brought a lot of new ideas to the table, including feminist foreign policy and more women in offices, and of course, also environmental politics. And then there was sort of the third party, which is the smallest, but now has become a very important player in the breakdown as well. And that is the Free Democratic Party, who had the finance ministry, which is a key ministry and part of why this coalition eventually collapsed.
Yeah, and you might talk us through that. What were the big issues that kind of caused the strain for them to get to this point?
It's a very interesting development that we've seen there, because some people have compared it to an ugly divorce, what we're seeing at the moment. But I found that rather surprising because, you know, with a divorce, you would assume there has been a marriage, maybe even a honeymoon and some love. And I think there actually wasn't very much love at all, and right from the beginning. So it's always been their different personalities, their different political priorities. And it's been about compromising a lot. So and that since 2021. And it really just seems that the bickering that was happening more internally has now become very public and has led to the absolute breakdown. So it was actually then the sacking of the finance minister that has now triggered the collapse of the government.
And what brought about that sacking? Because the manner of it, even in itself, was kind of very interesting. Scholz often seen as someone who's very robotic and, you know, without emotion. He was very angry, it certainly appeared. But maybe talk us through what precipitated that action to sack the finance minister.
So this is really something that we're not quite sure about yet. What we know is that Lindner, the finance minister, is a member, is the chair of the Free Democratic Party, and they really they believe in the economy and making the economy as strong as possible in a way that might mean sacrificing other things that are very important to the Social Democrats. So we're talking about social welfare, but we're also talking about the war in Ukraine and what if any money could go into that. So these were discussions that have happened for a long time that must have got really intense now. And that the main thing was that they had to decide whether or not they're trying to aim to get out of debt, because Germany is still making a lot of debt. And the question is, will the country continue to do so? And Lindner took a very strong stance there, and all the other ministers said that he was absolutely unwilling to compromise. But what we have seen really is that nobody's taken any accountability in this breakdown. Nobody said, actually, maybe I've made a mistake. And so it's really hard to say who's right and who's wrong here from the outside, at least.
And Katharina, like, why does the election have to wait until February? Here, when an election's called, it happens within 3 or 4 weeks. It's defined in the constitution that it has to be a specific period of time. Why do you get such a big lead in, or is that common in Germany?
Yes. So Germany, I guess, in general, is quite slow, but many people believe that this is a really important thing, you know, having learned from the past and how fragile politics can be. There is a very formal process for everything, and that includes how new elections can come about. In fact, it's a rather complicated process. And I think there were some people who were trying to push for it to happen sooner. But then experts got involved in discussions that actually, from a point of process, this would be really difficult, probably impossible. So it is realistic to have it in 2025. And now we seem to agree that it will be on 23rd of February 2025. 25. Yeah.
And what happens in the meantime? You know, Scholz is obviously remaining there, but is that government effectively a kind of toothless tiger that doesn't actually do anything or have any real power? It's a really, really important time for the world, and they're such important players in the European economy, and in a wider sense, I think geopolitically, they're always important. You mentioned Ukraine there a second ago in the context of the budget and trying to balance the books. I mean, one of the big concerns is that if Trump decides to withdraw funding from Ukraine, maybe more of the burden falls on Europe, and in that European context, is more of the burden fall on Germany. And if you're waiting for an election, can that actually happen?
That's a very good question. I think that's what everybody's worried about. And there is a lot of fear and discontent at the moment. So it'll be quite difficult to manage that. But I think it's also important to say that there is quite a bit of common ground between the sort of conservatives, the Christian Democrat Union and Christian Social Union, and the Social Democrats when it comes to some key issues. So they're all very keen on making Europe and the European Union as strong as it could be. They're all committed to supporting Ukraine. And that's an interesting difference, for example, to some of the newer and other parties that are becoming stronger and more important, and we should perhaps also talk about. But there is still a sense of having to work together. It's just that, of course, it's not just about what happens in Germany. As you said, you know, we're looking at the world, we're looking at Europe, and we have already had a comment from Elon Musk who called Scholz a fool. So people getting involved in these discussions in a very emotional way. So it will be a very hard few weeks until we see that election.
Yeah. You mentioned the fragmentation of politics in Germany. Maybe let's take a little look at the opposition. Who are the main opposition to this government, and what are their policies like around things like helping Ukraine, defences in Europe? And I'm particularly interested in immigration, that issue. Is there any division between what the government parties say and what the opposition are planning to do?
Yeah, so that is a really interesting and complex landscape that we have. It's really changing quite quickly in Germany, because we've had like parties like the Greens that kind of emerged in the 80s, but now we have newer parties as well. And like in other European countries, there's really populist parties. So the AfD is probably the most important to mention here. It's stronger than ever right now, and it's surprisingly popular among young voters. It takes very radical stance when it comes to migration and asylum in particular, but also against gender. Very right-wing populist party in the sense that we see in many other countries as well. And parts of the party are even classified as right-wing extremists officially already. And there's another attempt to ban this party because it is seen as an extremist organization by many members of the mainstream parties. So the irony here is that the AfD is probably, could well be the second strongest party in this election, but nobody wants to work with this party. So it would be very difficult, impossible potentially, for them to find a coalition partner should they become as strong as they're predicted to be at the moment. So they're definitely a party to watch. They also have very strong views when it comes to environmentalism. That is something that they really don't want to put any money into. They just, yeah, very right-wing populist in the sense. And another newer party still is the Sarah Wagenknecht Alliance. And that's a very interesting party in many ways. It's currently projected to be around 7%. And of course, that could change. And it's named after founder and leader Sarah Wagenknecht. And she calls herself a left conservative. And so almost a bit of a contradiction.
Yeah.
And she says, well, she takes very hard and tough stances when it comes to migration, is very pro-Russia, but also is more pro like welfare than, for example, the AfD. So this is a party that is really hard to fit into the conventional left-right narrative, and that makes it even more complicated. But what we definitely see is that people who are frustrated about politics or really dissatisfied with mainstream political parties, they flock to these two new parties.
Yeah, and Katharina, when you say they're frustrated with politics and the government, what will be the key issues in the campaign? Because we're having a lot of discussions here in Ireland. We have a general election campaign, and you know, whilst the economy is going really well here and we're kind of an outlier in Europe, they're still talking on the doorsteps about bread and butter issues like inflation. So what are the key issues that will be prominent in this campaign?
Yeah, I think there are some interesting similarities, but also differences to Ireland in that sense that, for example, housing is not something that has become a big issue yet in Germany. But we have the discussion about immigration. That is a really important one. And of course, in the EU, within the Schengen zone, there's transnational agreements. And it's very interesting how different parties position themselves vis-a-vis these agreements. And Friedrich Merz, the conservative candidate, and probably the next chancellor, he positioned himself quite controversially there and said, well, you know, we will just not let people into the country anymore, even if that is challenging international agreements. And so we see that the whole discussion on immigration is a very strong one, and one that is very emotional. And it's also, a lot of it happens on social media and not necessarily in the mainstream or conventional media anymore. That will play a big role. And I think the other issue is the economy. Mm. Yeah, that's, you know, Germany is struggling a lot more than Ireland at the moment. And, you know, some of the biggest and strongest businesses are failing. And so that too is, of course, a huge factor in that fear that I mentioned earlier, that people really feel that something's got to change, really. Mm.
So, yeah, a lot of similarities, as you say. Look, Katharina, it's a very complex situation and you've explained it to us really well. And thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. That was Katharina Karcher, who is a senior lecturer with the University of Birmingham. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up after the break, Trump's trials. We'll break down where his legal cases stand with legal affairs editor of the Financial Times, Joe Miller. Join us after the break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we are again turning stateside. And now that the dust has settled on the election and Donald Trump is busy formulating his dream team, we thought it might be a good time to remind ourselves that the incoming president is still fighting a number of legal cases. Where do they stand and could they stand in his way? And who better to explain it all to us than Joe Miller, legal correspondent for the Financial Times. You're welcome back, Joe. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Mandy.
Now, just give us a nice little overview of the cases that are still ongoing, what they are, and who's taking them against Donald Trump.
Sure. Well, there's, technically speaking, still four criminal cases ongoing, and we can discuss how long they may be ongoing for shortly. But as things stand, as people will remember, there are two election interference cases essentially brought against Donald Trump for his alleged attempts to overturn the results of the last election, the 2020 election, and the events leading up to the riots on Capitol Hill on January the 6th. One of those cases is a federal case brought in Washington, D.C., and the other one is a state case brought in Georgia. Then there is another case to do with his retention of classified documents. You may remember those pictures of those boxes stacked in Mar-a-Lago, and he was alleged to have maintained very sensitive military documents once he left the White House without getting the prior permission to do so. And finally, there was perhaps the most high profile of all of the cases in the end, which was the state case here in New York, the so-called hush money case, in which he was accused of paying off a porn star who alleged an affair in the lead up to the 2016 election and disguising those payments in business records. And in May, of course, Donald Trump was convicted on 34 counts in that case, and he is currently awaiting sentencing.
Right. Now, let's maybe start with that one, because as I understand it, they're trying to get a conviction overturned on that, and there might be a ruling happening in the immediate future on that.
Indeed. So Donald Trump was scheduled to be sentenced later this month. His lawyers have already intervened since he won the election last week to say that there is no way you can sentence a sitting president. It would interfere with his constitutional duties, etc. And they also say that the judge should throw out the case in its entirety, because you may remember earlier in this year there was a Supreme Court decision which granted presidents broad immunity for official acts committed while in office. And they claim that some of the evidence in the case related to official acts, and therefore the trial should be declared a mistrial, etc. Now, the judge in the case has essentially said, hang on a minute, let me hear arguments from both sides over this, and then I'll decide, you know, firstly, whether the case should be thrown out, and secondly, if it is not thrown out, whether there should be a sentencing, etc. So all that is on hold at the moment. And it's important to point out, I think, that Donald Trump, unlike in the federal cases, which we can come on to, has no power to pardon himself in a state case. That power resides with the New York governor, who's a Democrat. And so if the judge decides to keep this case live, there is nothing technically that he could do to stop it going forward.
And what could happen to him, given that he's been found guilty? And if the judge did say it can go ahead, what might be the ultimate implications for Donald Trump?
I think it's important to say that even before he won re-election, very few people thought he would get a custodial sentence. It's very rare with this sort of crime, particularly for a first-time offender, for there to be any jail time. And, you know, besides for the fact that it's you know, cases essentially to do with bookkeeping, it's just not a felony charge that is often met with jail time in New York State. So the chances of him being incarcerated were always very small. Now that he is going into the Oval Office, I think they are even smaller because while the president has no power over state cases, it's legal scholars do believe that it would be unconstitutional to essentially interfere with the president's constitutional duties. So if you couldn't lock him up and prevent him from running the country. And so even if there was to be a custodial sentence, it would have to be deferred until he left office.
Right. So one way or another, whether his conviction is overturned or whether it goes ahead, he's not going to face any time. There's really no implications for him or his administration from this case. So that brings us neatly on to let's look at the first federal case. That's the case that has been taken about the 2020 election and the one where I suppose the biggest battle came that we were watching between him and Jack Smith. Yeah, Jack Smith. So maybe take us through the first of the two federal cases.
Right. So the federal cases, as you mentioned, the first one and the most potent one was surrounding Donald Trump's alleged attempts to overturn the election. And in truth, that case and the other federal case is now dead on arrival based on Donald Trump's win, because as soon as he gets the reins of the Justice Department and installs his own attorney general, he can just order the Justice Department to dismiss the cases entirely, which, of course, they would do. Nonetheless,
sorry, Joe, is that on the basis of the Supreme Court ruling that he's effectively immune?
No, it's just on the basis that
he controls things.
The federal government. Yes. So, you know, these are cases literally being brought by the administration, and the administration gets to control whether to bring these cases or not. It's, you know, entirely in the White House's control and in the department's control. Come January, when Donald Trump enters the White House, those cases are dead in any case. What we've seen, though, is that Donald Trump may not even have to bother to do that when he gets into office, because Jack Smith and Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, have essentially climbed down as soon as the election was over. Very soon afterwards, they filed to the judges in these cases, essentially saying they would like to wind them up and they're going to brief the courts on how they're going to do that. And the reason they give is that there's a longstanding policy against prosecuting a sitting president. And now that Trump is a sitting president, there is always, you know, going to be a sitting president. There is no point in continuing these cases. It remains to be seen whether they'll have a final hurrah and publish some form of report about the evidence that they've unearthed in either case to try and, you know, make that public and perhaps embarrass Trump slightly. But, you know, even if they do so, these cases have no teeth anymore.
So that's number two, dead in the water. But what of Jack Smith? What are the implications for him? I know that he's technically withdrawing this one, but you know, we heard in the run-up to the election Donald Trump very vociferously outlining that he was taking a score of who his enemies were. What could happen to Jack Smith as a result of all this?
That's true. I mean, there have been people around — Donald Trump hasn't said it as explicitly himself, but there have certainly been people around Donald Trump that have vowed retribution against various prosecutors, against Jack Smith, against Alvin Bragg here in New York, etc. And it remains to be seen what that really means. They will certainly, I'm sure, fire Jack Smith and fire many people within the Justice Department who worked on these cases and clean house, which is not that unusual. It should be said, you know, all new administrations really, at least when it comes to the top ranks of the Justice Department, install their allies. You know, that is the prerogative of a new president. Whether the Trump Justice Department will go after these people, I don't know. They could certainly launch investigations if they thought there was any foul play in their taxes or something like that, or in their private lives. You know, whether they'll be busy with many other things and, you know, not have the resources to devote to this kind of thing, remains to be seen. I mean, Matt Gaetz, who as of yesterday is the designated nominee by Trump for the Attorney General post, you know, he has been very vocal because he had a post on the Judiciary Committee, the House Judiciary Committee. And in that position, you know, he has talked about lawfare. He's talked about these people, the DOJ going after Trump and, you know, vowed to clean house, etc. So, you know, if there is anyone that would take that post who might enact retribution, it would be someone like Matt Gaetz. But he's not yet been confirmed, and we don't yet know what the new Justice Department would look like.
Okay, so we're on to court case number three now, the federal case. This is the one about the classified documents, right?
That's correct, yes. And that suffers exactly the same fate as the other Jack Smith case, which is the January 6th case. It was already on its last legs because a judge in Florida, a Trump-appointed federal judge, it should be said, had dismissed the case in its entirety following the Supreme Court's decision, actually somewhat related to the Supreme Court's decision. It gets a bit technical, but it was to do with one of the justices' notes on the Supreme Court decision. But nonetheless, she had dismissed it, and it was up to the Justice Department to mull whether to refile it or whether to protest against its dismissal, etc. So that was, in any case, on shaky ground. But once, as I say, you know, Trump takes control of the Justice Department, it will vanish into thin air, and it probably will vanish before that because Jack Smith will probably unwind it.
Yeah, if he's not sacked as well beforehand. That finally brings us to the Georgia case, is it? That's the state case on the election.
Correct. So that is another election interference case brought by the Fulton County District Attorney, Fannie Willis. And it charges Trump and a bunch of other people who are in the Trump White House with, you know, trying to overturn the election in Georgia. You may remember that famous phone call when Trump called the Secretary of State in Georgia asking him to find 11,000 something votes to overturn the state, to overturn the vote in the state. He, of course, refused to do so. That case is in deep trouble, too, although this time it has nothing really to do with Donald Trump himself. Yeah.
This is where the sublime went to the ridiculous, really.
Quite. Yeah. Yes. It is due to the actions and behavior of Fannie Willis herself, the district attorney, who, by the way, was reelected on election night by an enormous margin. She is a Democrat, but she got into trouble for not disclosing a relationship she had with a prosecutor she had hired to be front and center on the Trump case. When this was discovered, it led to a massive brouhaha. The prosecutor in question was taken off the case, or he took himself off the case, rather. But then the defense put in a series of motions, basically saying the case should be dismissed because of prosecutorial misconduct. And now a court of appeals in Georgia is currently mulling whether to throw it out in its entirety. And it should be said that the office, Fannie Willis's office, the office of the district attorney in Atlanta, has not just had this, you know, a hiccup. It's had various hiccups in other big cases it's brought. It seems to be somewhat shambolic. So Trump's chances of this, you know, having this case dismissed look fairly good, or at the very least kicked into the long grass.
So 4-for-4 really are going nowhere, Joe. And we had a long conversation about this when you had the accumulation of all these trials and they hadn't even started. And we were to both talking about and convinced that, you know, this was going to have massive implications for people voting for Donald Trump. They just wouldn't vote for a convicted felon. They wouldn't vote for somebody who was responsible for insurrection. So, and yet all of that has come to nothing. Did some of it maybe even help him, do you think?
Well, possibly. I think it's still unclear, based on exit polling, you know, how much these cases were a factor either way, because by the time it came to November, they were not front of center of many people's minds at all. And, you know, it sounds strange to sit here and say that, but, you know, we had two assassination attempts in the meantime. We had a change in the Democratic nominee with Joe Biden, you know, stepping down, etc. So it had somewhat faded into the background. But it's certainly true that the Democrats gambled that, you know, these legal cases would convince enough people not to vote for him and remind enough people of his alleged misdeeds has massively backfired. And certainly in the case of the New York hush money trial and conviction, there has been a lot of polling that suggests that, you know, especially Republicans, but even some Democrats believe this was a witch hunt. They believe this case, you know, would not have been brought against someone who was not called Donald Trump. And I have to say that in my conversations over the last few months with, you know, white collar lawyers in New York, who, you know, many of them have died in the world Democrats, privately they believe the same thing. So I think there is a lot of hand wringing in the Democratic establishment, at least when it comes to, you know, the trial that ended up being the most prominent one, and the effect it ultimately had. And I think what's really telling is that if you look at Kamala Harris's rallies towards the end, she hardly ever mentioned anything about the legal cases, because they must have realized that that message was going nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, just want to get your sense. It's hard to believe that it's just over a week ago since the election actually took place. But what's Donald Trump's demeanor been like since he has been effectively re-elected? I saw him this week going into the White House for the beginning of the transition and obviously appointing his new dream team. Do you think he's any more conciliatory, or does he seem even more bombastic now that he's on his way back to the White House?
I think, as with as ever with Donald Trump, it's a somewhat, you know, schizophrenic reaction to his election win. I think it, you know, observing it from the outside, it very much depends on who is being nice to him and who is flattering him. If you look at the recent, you know, list of cabinet nominees, some of them fall, you know, very well within the realm of quote unquote normal, i.e., you know, they wouldn't have had trouble fitting into a Bush administration or a previous Republican administration, people like, you know, Marco Rubio. And even though they've become Trump supporters of late, you know, very much out of the kind of center of the party. And then there are some completely off the wall picks, like Matt Gaetz, like Tulsi Gabbard, and people like that. And, you know, I think this kind of proves that there is no unifying theory of what a Trump administration should be. Pretty much like last time, there are various people pressing their case, various interest groups pressing their case, for want of a better word, you know, many different people sucking up to him, and all of them get a little bit, but none of them get everything.
Well, Joe, these cases won't go anywhere, but no doubt it will still be a busy time for you over there covering Donald Trump's next administration. Thank you, Joe, for being with us today. That was Joe Miller, legal correspondent for the Financial Times. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks as always to today's guests for giving us their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy. On research were Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. And Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's item, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday news papers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.